speaker, Heather S. from Fresno. Please give her a round of applause. My name's Heather. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 13th, 2006. And it's an honor to be here tonight. Thank you, Bill, for asking me to speak. And I always get really nervous when I'm asked to speak. And the first time I got asked to speak was at this meeting in Fresno where I'm from called Fresno Fellowship. And I had about a year sober or so, and I peed my pants as I was walking up to speak. And so I always, always have this fear that I'm going to pee my pants, like right as I'm walking up, but we're good. So, yeah, and then Boo was talking about no peeing in here, so I thought that was good. Anyways, I am an alcoholic. I grew up in a home where there was drinking. My father is an alcoholic, and my mother was kind of the opposite of that. She was real big into church, and so I had some exposure to a lot of my understanding growing up, and drinking was okay. I saw my dad do it, and I was always, always curious about these little gold flakes that he had in his Goldschlager, and I was just always really interested in it. And I had my first drink at 12, and it was Goldschlager, and then I didn't drink again until I was 15. And I didn't wake up the next morning and become a daily drinker, but it did progress in high school. I did start drinking at work at 16. And then by the time I graduated high school, I was 18, and I had become a morning drinker and a daily drinker by that time. Alcohol was never hard for me to get. I could always get it at my parents' house, or I had a fake ID by the time I was 18. When I was younger, I learned this language called Punjabi, and I could get alcohol at any corner store that I wanted to. So it was always available to me. And during that time, from 15 to 18, I went through a lot of stuff in high school, and I tried all these different outlets. I tried therapy, and I tried antidepressants, and all those things are great, but nothing worked like that drink. Nothing calmed those voices down. Nothing made that pain go away instantly like a drink did. And alcohol made everything better for me. And I continued to drink, and as I drank more, everything else in my life became less important. And my alcoholism became more important, And slowly, I lost friends. I was very close to losing jobs, but if I was ever caught drinking on the job, I always quit before I could get fired. Eventually I got to this place where my life was so, so small, and my drinking was so, so big. And by the time I was 21, I wasn't drinking in bars. I was an isolated, alone, depressed drinker. And all those things that I was drinking over originally, just were irrelevant by this time. My drinking was more of a problem than those things were, and I just got in this spot where I couldn't not drink, and I couldn't live without a drink. And I was 21 years old, and my life wasn't going anywhere, and I just imagined that I would eventually kill myself, and I was so, so depressed. I was so depressed. And towards the end, the last year of my drinking, my life, when I look back and I think about my life, then it feels like I'm talking about somebody else, because I just couldn't even imagine my life like that today. I would wake up and go to the liquor store at 6 in the morning, and I would be in dirty clothes for 4 or 5 days with puke on myself, and and I'd walk up to the counter and I'd be getting a fix at 6 in the morning, and that's just how I would start my day. And I did things for alcohol that I never, ever, ever imagined I would do. It took every part of my body, my soul, you know, and I sold myself for a bottle many times over. And I became somebody I just could not recognize. And so the last year of my drinking, I had a really good codependent who bathed me and fed me and took care of me really well. And I got to this place where, you know, somebody had shared with me that they had gotten sober, and they didn't tell me how they did it necessarily. I didn't know about AA. I didn't know that there was a solution here. And shit, I forgot to look what time I started. Anyway, so I had a coworker that had told me, you know, that he drank like I did, and he didn't do it anymore. And so my solution was that I was going to go to rehab, you know. And eventually I did go to rehab. I got an intervention done on me by my mom, and I decided I was going to go, you know. And I, through going to rehab, I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't get this program right away. I didn't work the steps right away. I didn't get a sponsor right away. And I didn't stop drinking right away. I'd go to meetings drunk, and when they would ask for AA-related announcements, I would tell them that I was looking for a sponsor. And, you know, eventually I got desperate enough where I did ask for help, and I realized that I couldn't do it on my own. And that was August 13th, 2006. And the day I got a sponsor, I haven't had to take a drink since. And the reason why I say that is because I confused that in early sobriety, that my sponsor was keeping me sober. And when I was on my second step, I had a spiritual encounter, and I realized that it was God keeping me sober. And that's important for me today, you know, to remember that. And you know, when I finally surrendered and worked the steps, I went at it with everything in me, just like I did my drinking, you know. And I got into service right away, and I slept with my big book at night for the first year or so of sobriety, because I used to sleep with a bottle in bed. And you know, when I first got sober, I had a couple seizures, and it's just crazy to look back and think about that, you know, that I was 22 or 23 years old having seizures, and thank God I got here, right? You know, and so I started working in steps right away. I started going to meetings right away. If there wasn't a service commitment that I could do at a meeting, I made one up. I would set up chairs. I would greet people. I would pick up trash. I would do anything I could. And, you know, things started changing for me in sobriety. My parents let me move back home. I started forming relationships with friends. I started believing in this higher power that I never thought I wanted anything to do with. And my life started changing. I started having all these firsts in sobriety, like showering. And, you know, little things, watching a movie and remembering it, brushing my teeth, putting on makeup, things like that. And my life started improving. And I remember when I had 6 months sober, my dad planted flowers for me. They were Heather flowers, and he couldn't tell me that he was proud of me, but I knew he was, and that was his way of showing me. And you know, and then I got a year sober, and I couldn't believe it. I thought I was like an old timer when I had a year. And I don't know, I have been in a lot of different forms of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've done some H&I, I've done Bridging the Gap, I've been on different service committees, and I've been through a lot of bad things in sobriety as well. You know, I've seen so many of my friends go out and die or commit suicide in the rooms, and no matter what I've gone through, there's always been somebody there, you know, in the rooms that has reached out and helped me. And And I've always been able to rely on the higher power and the steps, and I've never had a problem that I couldn't find a solution for in the book, you know. my life is so different today. You know, I'm a full-time student, and I got a scholarship to go to Fresno State for the major that I'm majoring in, and you know, I work full-time, and I make living amends to my parents by going and having lunch with them on a weekly basis, and I give back, you know, and I was able to be my sister's maid of honor in her wedding, and no matter what has happened in sobriety, you know, I've always known that I'm going to be okay. And, you know, I have relationships today with other people that care about me, and I have a relationship with a higher power, and I have a relationship with myself. And a couple months ago, my dad, who's an alcoholic, was hospitalized, and he almost died, and the people in the rooms reached out to me, and not one time did I think about drinking. Not one time did it ever cross my mind, like, oh, I need to have a drink if my dad dies. I was just at peace, like, everything's going to be okay no matter what happens. You know, I knew God had my back. I knew, you know, Rob had my back, and all these people reached out to me, and, you know, I just have a beautiful life today. I don't have to drink no matter what, and that wasn't the case for me, you know, before I got here. And I just want to thank you again, Joel, for asking me to speak. And I love AA, and I love you all, so thank you so much. Okay, now it's my privilege to introduce tonight's main speaker. Please help me offer a warm Tulare County welcome to our speaker tonight, Jack G. of Huntington, California.
Don't look at the gum. Sorry. I'm Jack Grisham, and I'm an alcoholic. And I actually have a suit and stuff in the car, and then Bill said I didn't need to wear it. So I feel like I do have a suit. It's in the car. And so you know I have, at least you know I brought one. And it's fun. I was thinking about when I was sitting there, because I actually showed up at this meeting, and it was like really a long drive, right? And the guy looks at me and says, "Where's your tie?" And I go, I don't have one. He goes, "Okay, well, we'll see you later then." I go, "What?" It's like an hour drive. But whatever. You know, I'm sure he ended up drunk somewhere, and that's okay. But I love being sober, and I'm with my wife, and we're fooling around, and everybody's so nice, and we're sitting up here visiting, you know, and somebody, I was at a meeting this morning, and I go to a lot of meetings, and I'm always doing this stuff. This is what I do, you know, and the topic of the meeting was, what do you do to stay sober? It's like, well, I don't know. I never thought about it. I never thought about what I do to stay sober, because this is what I do every day. It's not like I get up in the morning and go, "Oh, I got to stay sober today." It's like I just get up in the morning. You know what I mean? And then what goes on? Oh, the phone rings, and go to a morning meeting, and we start with a prayer, and, you know, my wife and I hang out together, and we fool around, and we got new people calling all day long, and we're always running around somewhere, and we got a book study at the house, and, you know, our house is open door, and there's people in and out, and I don't do anything to stay sober. It's just this. You know what I mean? I just do this. And because my life's changed. It's a completely different way of life. And I get in arguments with guys sometimes, and they say, "I do contrary action." I do not. I don't do any contrary action. If I did contrary action today, it'd mean I was drunk. That's what it would mean. Because contrary to what I do is what I used to do, and I don't do that anymore. I do primary action. That's what this is. Primary, not contrary. Maybe contrary to when I was drinking, but surely not now. You know, I want to call my sponsor. I love him. You know, he's 45 years sober. He's a great old guy. You know, and we sit and we chat together and we tell stories. And my grand sponsor got sober with Bill Wilson and those guys on the East Coast. And, you know, and it's just, I like talking to him. You know, how would you not like talking to him? And, sure, I don't know, maybe that doesn't make any sense to you, but it makes sense to me. And or maybe it doesn't make sense to me, but I don't care because I don't worry about making sense because I'm sober anyway. So, And I'll start with this. I'm a book guy. We were talking. I'm a book guy, right? But it does get scary. All right. So before you get mad at me, I just want to say I'm a book guy, and then you'll get mad in a second. But like it, any good alcoholic, once you become a book guy, then you really become a book guy. You know what I mean? It's like now we're reading every line, and I got crazy with it. You know, I started hunting people down, just going like nuts, panicking nuts. So I'm the book guy, and I'm tearing apart every line, and I'm getting old dictionaries, and I'm going through that, and I'm hunting guys that are still alive up, and I'm going to Oxford Group, guys, because there is Oxford Group does still go on. It's called Moral Rearmament or whatever now. That's what it's called, but there is still an Oxford Group. So I was going to those guys saying, hey, where did Bill steal this? Where did this come from? Because there's sections of our big book that are directly taken from the Oxford Group. I mean, literally, it's plagiarism. I mean, it's basically taken out. And I said, I go, well, why didn't they sue Bill? Like, why didn't they bum out on Bill? And it was because the leader of the Oxford Group told Bill, you go ahead and save those alcoholics. We have worlds to save. That's what he said. So they didn't care that Bill took stuff. So I start hunting this down. And I'm hunting it down and digging in and tearing in and looking at it and getting really like, you know what I mean? Just crazy with it, right? And then I start going to meetings and I start tearing you guys apart because you're not doing it right. So I'd hear somebody and me go, oh, bullshit. You know, just going crazy. It got bad, man. I felt sorry for the new guys that were sitting next to me because I'd be mumbling through the meeting. He's wrong. He's wrong. It, you know, got bad. And then it got really scary. Then I started confronting people about how wrong they were. My old sponsor used to call me the sheriff. That was the joke. It's like, the sheriff just rolled in. You know, it's like, you know, and they got a little badge for me. They thought it was funny, too. But, I mean, I heard this guy say one time, this guy's talking in a meeting, and he just says something so crazy. I don't even know what the hell it was, but it was something that he had repeated and didn't really put a lot of thought into, right? I said, where did you get that? He goes, I got it from my sponsor who got it from his sponsor. I go, then your grand sponsor is an idiot. You know, so it got scary, right? All right. So it got to the point where it was Jack Grisham, party of one at the meeting, right? Now, at the same time I'm tearing the big book apart, I start tearing the New Testament apart. Because, hey, you know, I finished one, I'm going into the other, right? So I start getting up into that. And so I go, and I'm trying to find somebody to talk about God's stuff with. Because I'm not associated with any church or anything like that. And this is not an outside issue. I'm just saying, this is what I do. Whatever. So I'm not associated with any of that, but I can't find anybody to talk about God with. I mean, I don't know if you realize how we talk about God in here versus how they talk about God out there. Or even how they talk about God in here on Sunday. We talk about God completely different. They talk about God as God. We talk about God as, yeah, God and I just ran over Taco Bell and got a couple of tacos. You know, it gets a little out there. You know what I'm saying? Because we got this real personal God thing going on in here, a lot of us, you know. Not God out here, God right up in here. And so I'd be wandering around outside and I'd see somebody like reading the Bible or something. And I'd walk up and go, hey, we got the same dad. And they'd shut the book, you know what I mean? You know, completely the opposite. Normally, they come up to you and you run, right? It's like, I'm going up to them and they're running. And that got frightened. So what I'm doing, I'm thinking, well, what am I going to do? Who am I going to talk to about this stuff? So what I did is I went to a Jesuit brother, and I'm not Catholic, like I said, I'm not wound up, but I really like this other Jesuit, Father DeMello, and I love Father DeMello, and I wanted to talk to him, but he's dead, so I can't talk to him, and a lot of the guys I want to question have been dead for a long time, right? So I actually hunted down Father DeMello's people to say, hey, do you got anybody that talks like him that I can speak with? And they go, well, I guess you could contact New York. So I contacted New York and said, you got anybody out there I can talk to about this stuff? You know, and they go, well, you can contact these people down in California. So I started seeing this Jesuit brother. And I'm going in, and he's a spiritual advisor. That's what he's called. And Bill actually uses that term. Father Dowling was Bill's spiritual advisor. And he was a Jesuit brother. Same thing. And they go and talk about the Spirit. So I started seeing this Jesuit brother, and we would go in, and he'd say, Jack, what are you studying? What are you doing? And we'd just talk about God's stuff. And anyway, so after tearing the big book apart, I mean ripping that book apart, and I still do a book study at my house every Monday night from 6 to 6:45. We don't do any readings. We just jump right in, and I shove that book up people's rumps one line at a time, man, every Monday. Every Monday. And sometimes people will leave and they won't come back for a month and we're only one more paragraph down. You know what I'm saying? This is important, this is. You know, it's crazy. All right, so anyway. So I'm tearing the big book apart, done with that. Now I start tearing the New Testament apart. And then I go into Brother Charlie one day. I said, Charlie, what's the best translation of the New Testament? What do you think is the best translation? Because I want to really know what's going on. And I'm thinking Brother Charlie's going to tell me, Jack, you need to learn Aramaic or whatever it is, right? And it's like, I'm in. I'll learn it. Whatever you do. And I go, Charlie, come on, man. What do you think is the best translation? And he looks at me and he says, wow, it is such a shame that you're that hung up on the words. I go, what? He goes, it's a shame you're that hung up on the words, Jack. He goes, I don't want to hear another word of Scripture coming out of your mouth. He goes, I need you to shut the book and I want you to stop it. And I'm like, looking at him, I'm thinking he's going to tell me to go do some heavy studying or something. He tells me to stop. And he goes, as a matter of fact, he goes, I don't want you to see you pick up that book again. He goes, what I want you to do is I want you to go out to the beach. We live down by the beach. He said, I want you to take a walk. And when you take that walk, I want you to ask God to walk along with you. And I want you to just listen. Just be quiet and just listen. What I did by taking that walk and being quiet and listening is all of a sudden the way I was operating started coming clearer to me. What I realized was by tearing apart the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, line by line, word by word, what I was basically trying to do was control the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I could pin you down to a line or a phrase, then I controlled this program. What I also looked at by tearing apart the New Testament at the time is what I was trying to do is, if I could pin my God down to a line or a phrase, then therefore I controlled God. I went back and looked at the big book that I had dissected. The big book that had become so rigid, so stiff, so this is this, all the way through the book. And I took another look at the book, and all of a sudden, all the stiffness, the rigidity of the book had just completely disappeared. And I'm looking at it, and I look at the third step, and it's a great step, and I love the third step prayer in there, right? And we get our new guys, we say, learn this prayer. And I always tell people, I say, hey, if you're going to learn the prayer, you might want to take it apart. What does it mean to you? What are you saying? Don't just go parrot a prayer. What does it mean? And I look at that prayer, and do you know what Bill says at the end of the third step prayer in the book? He says, the wording is optional. Optional. You can say anything you want for a third step prayer. Do you know some people's third step prayer is F it, I can't take this crap anymore. That is a very valid third step prayer. I'll tell you, you know what, and I've actually in the long run, in the 25 years I've been sober, in the long run, I have actually seen more people stay sober by saying that prayer. By saying, F it, I can't take it anymore, I'll do whatever you want. I'm in. That was my prayer. That's what I said. Stayed sober. Then I go look at the fourth step in the big book, and it's lines and columns and laid out, and what a nice graph, and all nicely laid out, right? Do you know what it says before the lines and the columns? It says, we were usually as definite as this example. Usually. Not always. Sometimes we do other crap around here. And if you go into the back of the book, There's a fourth step that Dr. Bob does with a guy, our co-founder, Dr. Bob, Bill and Bob. There's a fourth step that Dr. Bob does with a guy, and it's completely different than the fourth step that Bill did. In the fourth step that Dr. Bob does with a guy, Bob listened to the guy's story, and Bob took notes. And when the guy was done telling his story, Bob gave him his defects of character. You're sarcastic. You're intolerant. You're jealous. Bob gave it to him. And think about this. I mean, I love it when guys are new and you go and do the columns. That's great. You follow orders. Good. I'm glad you're following orders. And it's a great way to take a fourth step. You want to take a real fourth step? Give paper and pencil to everyone that knows you. And you have them fill out a fourth step for you. Believe me, you will have a list of defects that you have never seen before in your life. And if you want to go even further with it, give pencil and paper to your enemies and say, would you mind? I can't. You know, sometimes in AA, it's such an incestuous little thing that we got going on in here, and we're so in here, and we're so in here, and we're all together, and we're up in all this stuff right here. And when people come and leave, a lot of times we say, well, they left because they're sick. They're sick because they left. Not often do you see people say, that person left, I wonder how we failed them. How did we fail being of service to these people? Why are they leaving us? Sometimes for the hell of it, I'll get on the internet and I'll type in F-U-C-K-A-A and hit enter to see what they're saying about us. To see. Why are you unwilling to look at what our people that we fail say about us? Why can't you look and say, you know what, these guys may be right. Maybe there is things that we're doing here that we could serve people better and we're not doing it. And I'll tell you, if you look on the internet, do you know that most of those people are upset with us? Not for our program. That's what's the crazy thing about it is. I have never got on the internet and saw someone say, I'm not a fan of AA, they let you believe or not believe, however you feel like it. They suck over there. Never seen it. I've never seen someone say, I hate AA. They admit their faults. Never seen it. I've never seen somebody write, you know, AA sucks. They pay back their bills. Never seen it, ever. I hate those guys in AA. They owed me money and paid me back. That program sucks. I've never seen it. What you see in there is when we step outside the traditions of our program, when we try to supplant God, when we try in front, when we try to run people's lives, when we do all that stuff that we're not supposed to be doing, in our tradition says we're not supposed to be doing it. When we break our own traditions, when we break them, that's what they complain about. Anyway, I go back to that big book and I start looking at that big book and everything that I thought was so rigid, it all of a sudden completely disappeared. When it talks about us getting back together with our wives and kids, it says, well, you'll know when it's time to know. Your wife and you, whatever, it's different for everybody. You know, different for everybody. Each different experience for everybody. Going all through that book, it completely disappeared. And you know that Bill sums the program up in four lines at the end? After all that talking, Bill sums our whole program up in four lines. He says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you have. And join us. That's it. Four simple lines. To somebody, they abandon themselves to God this way. Someone else abandons themselves to God another way. Some people admit their faults this way, some people another. Some people clear away the wreckage of their past this way, some people do another. Really interesting. And I'll tell you, I do a Saturday meeting, and I'm not there, it's being covered for me now. I do a Saturday meeting in Long Beach, and what I do is I get people with long-term sobriety, and we sit in front of the group, and it's a couple hundred people, and I question them about their sobriety. We don't talk any drunkalogue, nothing. We start day one in AA. How did you get a sponsor? How did you work a first step? How did you do a third step? What was a fourth step looking like? What did they have you do? And I tell you, we have had guys in plus 50 years of sobriety, and we have gone over a little over a year now, every week, a different long timer, every week, and you know what? We've gotten a different story out of every single one of them. Every single one of them has told us a different story within the framework of our 12 steps. They've all taken an inventory. They've all turned themselves over to this greater power. They've all cleared up their past, and it looks completely different for every one of them. Interesting. So I'll tell you how I got here. I was living at my mother's. And if it was up to my mother, I would still be living at my mother's right now. The Al-Anon people never got one hand on my mom. Not one. The blood of the lamb was spray painted on our front door, and the Al-Anons just drifted right on by. It's frightening. I would go to jail. When I'd get out of jail, my mother'd go, "They're always picking on you, sweetheart." I would be passed out in the neighbor's yard anytime day or night with my pants off, laying out on the yard. If the neighbors had balls enough to complain, my mother would say, "Leave him alone, he's an artist." You know, it was bad. And she's still like that. I'll tell you just a real quick story. I don't want to go too long. My mother has not changed, and it's really sad because my niece is actually taking advantage of her right now, so it's really rough. My mom just got injured, and they didn't tell us, and it's just really, very uncomfortable situation. But I tell you how my mom hasn't changed. We got five kids, and my 14 year old daughter, she came up to me one day and she goes, "Pops, I got something I gotta tell you." They call me Pops, right? She goes, "Pops, I got something I gotta tell you." I go, "What's up?" She goes, "I toilet paper the house." "Hang on." "Thanks. Well, tell me. Go play. What do you want me to do about it?" You know what I mean? She's like, "Okay, thanks, Dad." And she takes off, right? No big deal. Then I get a call from her mom and she says, "You've got to go to parenting classes." I go, "For what? For what?" She goes, "The toilet papering. Your daughter's on probation." I go, "What? What do you mean she's on probation? What are you talking about? It's toilet papering." So I'm angry, right? So I go down to this parenting class that they have, and it's like a room full of criminals and me and baby girl there. You know what I mean? This little freckle-faced, blonde volleyball player girl with a bunch of, like, "What's up, man?" And, you know, hanging out in this parenting class. So now I'm getting really angry. So I want to speak to the detective in charge. Now, I'm pissed. I'm a taxpayer. Well, I file. I don't pay, but I file, right? So I want to speak to the detective in charge. So I go to this detective's office, and I roll in hot. You know how we roll in hot a little bit sometimes? So I roll in hot. I go, "What are you doing? Pulling baby girl off the street? What are you, people shooting each other around?" I live in downtown Huntington. Nobody's shooting anybody down there. We live on the beach, you know what I mean? It's like, I know there's people murdered in the streets, and you're pulling baby girl out for toilet paper. What's wrong with you people? And he goes, "What do you know about the case?" I go, "The case?" He goes, "That's what I thought." And he pulls out this big file, and he slides it across the desk at me, and I open it up, and on page one, there's a photograph of the side of a house, and on the side of a house, drawn in black magic marker, is a poorly drawn penis with the words, "Suck my thing" on there. And I look at my kid, and she's got her head like this, right? And the only reason she didn't get a spanking is it was a poorly drawn penis. Right? I could tell that she had never actually seen the real thing. You know what I'm saying? It looked like a beach ball with a triangle on top of it. I go, "Right." You know, so, but, okay, but the whole point of this story is, this is just this stupid story. The whole point is, I told my mother this story at lunch. We had lunch, and I tell my mother the story. And I go, "Man," I go, "she's in trouble, blah, blah, blah." My mom goes, "Oh, what for?" I go, "They vandalized the house, Mom." She goes, "Well, how close was it to Halloween?" What? I go, "They drew on the house." "I'm sure they did. Kids will be kids, sweetheart." You know, it's like, so she's still co-signing this craziness. All right, anyway, so here's what's going on. I'm living at my mother's house. And here's how I got to you guys. Here's how I got to you. A buddy of mine got busted on a cocaine trafficking charge, right? Now, I believe that more alcoholics are created in court than anywhere else in the world. It's not the first drink, it's not the local bar, it's court. It really is court. Because hundreds of thousands of us go into court every day, non-alcoholics. And we get in front of a judge. Judge says, Mr. Smith, you're looking at a year's sentence. But if you're an alcoholic, you could do a 90-day treatment program. I'm an alcoholic, Your Honor. Right? Everybody is now, right? Not so. Not so. For our people that are brand new in here, if you're brand new, like first time in AA, and then because sometimes we like to run, then let people think, whatever. Anyway, so if you're brand new and you start saying, oh, I love this, I'm doing a great job, I'm so happy to be here, stop now. You know what I mean? Because we know you're not that happy to be here. You're in AA. You know what I mean? It's for you. All your plans have ended you right here in AA. You know what I'm saying? And my friend Frank used to say, if you're happy to be here, you're too sick to stay, my friend, and so yeah, I mean, you got to be a little upset for being in here. So anyway, and I'll tell you why. You might as well just start telling us the truth from the very start, because love and tolerance is our code, and we have to love you no matter what you say. You could walk into an AA meeting, stand up, cuss us all out, flip us off, tell us to go to hell, wherever to go, and we'll just clap and tell you to keep coming back. Yeah! Yeah! Come on! Anyway, and the other thing that I found out is, no matter what you say in AA, no matter what you say in here, someone will disagree with you. You can say, the ocean is wet. Somebody else will stand up and go, not along the edge, it's not. No, sir, that is not. I mean, it's crazy. You know what I mean? You come in here and they argue these steps and these traditions like it's the Constitution, man. It's crazy, you know? Anyway, so I was at a convention and I said that joke about more alcoholics being created in court. And it's a joke, but it's a funny joke, because it's true, right? I said that, and this dude at this convention walks up to me, and he's huge. I'm 6'4". He's got a couple inches on me, right? And he's just got bad tattoos all over me. He goes, can I talk to you, man? I go, yeah, what's up, bro? He goes, I did the year, dog. Well, then you're a stupid alcoholic. It's like, God, if you don't got enough sense to cop a plea to stay out of jail, you better come on up in here and start working steps, guy, because you're going to die out there, my friend, with that weak game you got. Anyway, so I make that joke about more out, that's fine. So this is what happened to my buddy. He goes to court and says he has a problem. He did not have a problem 2 weeks before that. I was getting loaded with him. You know what I mean? There was no problem mentioned at all. It wasn't like, hey, Jack, you know what? I think I got a problem. I'm going to set out on this last line of blow. Why don't you clean that up for us? I'm going to set back on this one. You know? No! It was, are you cutting that even, dude? There was no problem mentioned. But now, because he's going to court, and he's got a charge, and he's going up to L.A. County, and he's a little 5-foot-something, freckled-faced, curly-blonde-haired white boy, yes, he does indeed have a problem now. So he goes to court, and you H&I guys get up there, and you start healing on him, or whatever the hell's going on up in there, pumping him full of the spirit, getting them all healed up. And he gets out of there, and he starts out as a reformer. A reformer. The big book says we're not supposed to start out as reformers, but that's what this guy did. And real quick, just if you don't mind, sorry, I'm going to take this one. The book says a whole bunch of stuff in here. There's a lot of stuff in this book. And what a lot of people don't realize is in the beginning, they wanted to sell this. You know, that was the deal. When they came up with this program, and I'm not making this up. You can look in history. They wanted to do it. That's why they went to Rockefeller. That's why they went after these guys. They wanted to sell this to big corporations. That was the deal. We've got a solution for alcoholism. We're going to save you tons of money. We're going to make it happen. And they wanted to sell it, but nobody was buying. So then they just had to give it away. You know what I mean? That's why we give it away. Somebody's going to buy it. But anyway, so... But it's funny, so I'm going through the book one time, and like I said, I go through the book a lot, and so I'm going through the book, and I'm thinking about them being salesmen. Like I'm thinking, okay, Bill, the hustler, and they even have an auto polish scam. Do you know that? Like when AA first started, they had this, I think it was Honest Jim's Auto Polish, or I don't know the exact name, but they were selling auto polish and doing all sorts of weird crap, you know? So anyway, so I'm going through the book, and I'm reading it, and I'm thinking about them being hustlers, and then I thought, oh my God, I just found the sales pitch for Alcoholics Anonymous. Have you ever watched late night TV when they're doing like Viagra commercials or whatever? You know what I mean? And I just did this. Anyway, so, and they're doing Viagra commercials and then they paint this bitchin' picture. It's like, you're going to have a great time. The party's on tonight. You and her, woo! You know, that whole thing, right? And then the commercial, and you see they're all stoked, and they're winking, and they're going crazy. So I'm reading the big book. I go, oh, my God, I just found the sales pitch for AA. And here it is right here. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. Isn't that beautiful? So yeah, right. So, I mean, you know what I mean? You can just picture like the well-dressed drunk winking and just like, you know, yeah, just, you know, they waving the big book, right? But then what happens? So then the commercial's almost over. So then what starts rolling? All of a sudden the fine print starts rolling at the end of the commercial because there's shit that can go wrong sometimes, right? And so I flip a couple more pages over and I go, oh my God, I just found the small print. And here it is right here. It may mean the loss of many nights' sleep, great interference with your pleasures, interruptions to your business. It may mean sharing your money in your home, counseling frantic wives and relatives, innumerable trips to police courts, sanitariums, hospitals, jails, and asylums. Your telephone may jangle at any time of the day or night. Your wife may sometimes say she is neglected. A drunk may smash a burger in your home or burn a mattress. You may have to fight with him if he is violent. Sometimes you'll have to call a doctor to administer sedatives under his direction. Another time you may have to send for the police or an ambulance. The fantastic. Yeah, so they got the small print on the back. Anyway, so whatever. There's all sorts of crap in that book like that. And, you know, and I always tell new guys, you know, if your sponsor says read the book, oh, yeah, give it to me. I'll read it. There's some good stuff in there. Anyway, so my buddy gets busted. The H&I guys get him set up, and he comes back to the neighborhood, and he's going to, like I said, a reformer. He's going to heal everybody. He's going to get everybody going. You know when that guy gets pumped up? It's just like Bill talked about when Ebby came to Bill, right? He's going, oh my God, here he comes, you know. I got to deal with this. I hope the booze lasts longer than this, you know. So, and that's what my buddy does. He starts out with this crazy walking hand in hand with Bill, Bob, and Jesus thing or whatever's going on, right? And he's going to save the neighborhood. Where's his first stop? My mother's house. Stop number one. I get this. I go, hey, what's up, bro?
He goes, you've got a problem, man.
I go, what? He goes, you're an alcoholic. I go, no. No, I'm not. Live with my mom. So let me tell you what was going on at mommy's house at the time. I had warrants out for my arrest. So what? I always have warrants out for my arrest. That's how you pay tickets. Sad if you laugh at that. Anyway, you tell that to a normie and they just twitch their head. They don't understand. I also have people trying to kill me, both real and imagined. I got a girl pregnant. I said, move in. Move into adopted me. Let's have a baby. She's one of the many women that I'm dating at the time. I had overlapping girlfriends since third grade. She gets pregnant. I said, move in. Let's roll. 26 years old. Mental capabilities of a 12-year-old. I'm going to be a dad. At the same time she moves in, I fall in love with a girl of questionable age, and I take her to Mexico and marry her. Yeah, that's where the laughter stops, right there, man. What? Anyway, and that's what's going on at my mother's house. And my mom's co-signing all of it.
Do you need money for the train to get down south?
Sad. Anyway, so and this guy's calling me an alcoholic, right? So I get him away from the front door. I don't want my mother to hear this kind of talk up in there, right? And I get him out on the front porch outside. I get him out on the lawn. And he says, come to a meeting with me. I go, a meeting? A meeting of what? He goes, 12-step meeting. Come on down. I go, no. No. I go, you go, bro. I say, you get popped. You go. He goes, come to a meeting. No. Come to a meeting. No. No, no, no. Come on. No. Come on. Come to a meeting. No. Come to the meeting. No. Come to the meeting. No. Come to... No. Come on. No. No. Come to... No. Come on. Come to the meeting. No. Come on, Jack. Come to me. Okay. I'll go. Now, you know why I said I'll go? Because I'm an alcoholic. That's right. And I'll say anything to get you to leave me alone, including I'm Jack Grisham and I'm an alcoholic. I got a couple of problems with Alcoholics Anonymous. It's okay to have problems with Alcoholics Anonymous. Not with the steps, not with the traditions, not with the concepts I'm in. This program is unbelievable. My problems are the same problems that Bill had. Problems with us. The membership. That's the problem. Do you know what's wrong with AA? Loaded with alcoholics. That's what's wrong with AA. And one of the problems I have is we are too quick to get the new man and the new woman to say they're an alcoholic. And we push them into it. Say you're an alcoholic. Just say you're an alcoholic. Don't say addict, goddammit. Say you're an alcoholic. Say you're an alcoholic. And we push them into it. And you have people in here claiming alcoholism, and they have no idea what they're even saying. And have you ever been to a meeting where they go around the room and introduce themselves before the meeting starts, and a guy's there in a court card? I'm Bud Alcoholic. I'm John Alcoholic. I'm Frank Alcoholic. I'm Tim. I'm here in a court card. Woo! The whole room goes crazy. Like a bunch of monkeys let out of a cage. They just start shaking and shaking. We got one. 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 The whole meeting changes. And when the meeting starts, the whole meeting is dedicated to Tim and his denial. I remember when I, too, came in on a court car. Unbelievable! The guy isn't even an alcoholic. He was out shooting golf. He shot a bad round. He went to the clubhouse. He had one cocktail too many. Pulled out onto the highway, got popped, got a 502 or whatever the hell they're calling it these days, got arrested, went to court, and he was smart enough. When the judge said, you've got a problem, he goes, you bet I do. He was smart enough to say he was an alcoholic and get in here. But it doesn't make him an alcoholic. You know, I tell people all the time, Alcoholics Anonymous is a scam. It's a scam. And if you don't think it's a scam, you're fooling yourself. Because people use this to get out of jail, lengthy jail sentences every day. Every day. Because they're told, say you got a problem. They'll put you in a program. They'll cut the time down. You'll say, go get a court card, bro. Get it filled out before you go in. All the time it goes on. That's a scam. That's a scam. Now, for us, it happens to be something that works. But for a lot of people, it's a way to get out of trouble. And that's what this guy did. And let me tell you something. The next time he goes to that meeting and it goes around the room and everybody, I'm Jim Alcoholic, I'm Bob Alcoholic, I'm Tony Alcoholic, I'm Tim, I'm also an alcoholic. Now, does he think he's any more of an alcoholic than he was before? No. No. He just wants you to leave him alone. Leave me alone. Sign my court card. Let me go. Let me go. Anyway, if you're brand new in here, saying you're an alcoholic, and you're in an AA meeting, this is an AA meeting, and you're surrounded with alcoholics, and you're saying you're one of us, and you're in a meeting, what you are claiming when you say you're an alcoholic is you are claiming a fatal illness. Fatal means it's going to kill you. Stop worrying about the mole on your back. It's the booze. And not only is it a fatal illness, but you're sitting in an AA meeting, saying they're an alcoholic. In our literature, it talks about a fatal illness that only a God experience can arrest. Do you know how terrifying that is? If you accept that as that is, frightening. Could you imagine going into a doctor's office and giving tests? When I first came in here and said this, I go, giving tests. And now I'm 52. Giving tests. So now it's down. And my wife got good insurance, so right after we got married, she goes, I need you to get a couple things looked at. Anyway, so I've had pipes up every end of me. Anyway, all right. But I can guarantee you that I am not full of crap right now after a recent colonoscopy. But could you imagine you go into the doctor's office and you give your test and you come back 3 days later and you go, hey, how'd it go? He goes, no. What do you mean, no? Fatal. What? Fatal. You're done, sir. What? Fatal. You don't even need to pay your bill. Bye-bye. Fatal. You're done. And though not a religious man, I favor prayer in cases such as yours. Do you know how terrifying that is? Do you also know that there's a story in the big book that says the same thing? And I'm not talking hidden story in the back. This is up in the front. And the doctor says, hey, I don't even like treating people such as you. And though not a religious man, I favor prayer in cases such as yours. That is frightening. You come up in here and hear it, you don't believe it. You go to a doctor and hear it about any other thing, and you believe it. You know, I get into it with guys a lot of times about this, and about alcoholism, and about accepting, which is believing that you really have a fatal illness. Because you see people say they have an illness, they'll go, yes, I'm an alcoholic, but you don't see them doing anything about it. I've been shot at a number of times, as you can imagine. And I tell you, when you're getting shot at, I don't care how tough the guy is next to you, when people start shooting, everybody goes down to the ground. Everybody ducks. And their voices go up like 2 octaves. Did you see which way it was coming from? It looks like they go up. It's not until the guy drives off. When the guy drives off, then they stand up and go, I would have kicked his ass, man. You know, but when the shots are firing, everybody does it, right?
And what's up, dude?
Anyway, so. But they think they're going to get killed because you're getting shot at. They think they're going to get killed. But in here, you see a new person come in, say they're an alcoholic, and you don't see them ducking. You don't see them getting a commitment, getting a sponsor, jumping in this thing, reading the book, doing any of this stuff that has saved our lives. Because they don't really believe it. They don't really believe they're an alcoholic. And the book talks about it. The book talks about trying to get the new person to believe, to see they're an alcoholic. To try to get them to see it. It's impossible. You know, and here's where we start going in front of God. I hear guys sometimes say, I make my people do a first step. I make them do that first step. Really? You make your people admit to their innermost self that they're an alcoholic. How the hell do you do that? Then I hear guys go, I make my people do a third step. I make them do a third step. Really? You make your guy turn his will and his life over the care of God. How do you do that? We should send you to the Middle East. And do you know that there were papers written on this back in 1939? The same thing that I'm talking about right now? H. Kiva, one of the first guys that backed AA, said compliance versus surrender. He said that you'll see guys follow orders, which is compliance, but it doesn't mean they've surrendered. It just means they're following orders. There's guys in prison right now dressing as the warden decrees, showing up, going to chow, commissary, going wherever they do as told, dressed as told. But it does not mean they have changed. It means they're following orders. You can't make someone do a first step. You can't make them do a third step. Yeah, great, you can have them write stuff out. You can do all that stuff. But it doesn't mean it came in here. It's a big difference. Our friend Joe Millard, there's a service for him tomorrow. He got sober in 1964 and he just died. Joe used to say, pity the heart that's slow to learn what the quick mind sees at every turn. Meaning you can learn it in your head all you want. Acceptance does not come in the head, it comes in here. It comes in the soul and it's different. Anyway, I go to this first meeting I go to, and the meeting I went to, so we just go back. I'm going to the meeting. Well, you got an ADD swing with me. When I go, you just got to go right along with it. So anyway, I told the guy I'm going to go to the meeting, right? I'm going to go to the meeting, and my mother finds out I'm going to the meeting, right? She's like, are you going to that ANA, sweetheart? I go, yes, I am, mother. Would you like a couple dollars for coffee? I need 40. They've got dues down there, Mom. Anyway, so I go to my first meeting, and here's how I roll in. It's a night meeting. I'm wearing a pair of ragged old shorts. It's these ragged shorts. I got a Dickies work shirt, and it's got cigarette burn holes all over the top of it. All my shirts had burn holes in it, because I'd be hammered and smoking. Hey, I'd say something to you, so I put my cigarette down for a second. And people would just come up and go, dude, you're on fire, man. No. No. You're on fire, asshole. Just rough. I had nice shoes on, though, at the time. I was in my friend's wedding. I kept the shoes. So I got these shiny black patent leather shoes on with a thing, burn holes, ragged shorts. My hair at the time was down to my elbows, right, full of knots. Little do I know, there's a Jolly Rancher in the back of it. I guess I had passed out, and then the Rancher just came out of my mouth and just slid around into the back. And then I got up in the morning, I'm like, I'm good, right? But at the time, I'm walking tall because I got 40 from my mother, and I don't know the Rancher's back there. So anyway, and I always get teased. It was just my birthday, and people send me pictures of Jolly Ranchers for my birthday because they don't like me to forget where I come from. Anyway, so I living in my mom's, warrants out for my arrest, living, everything's a mess, everything's destroyed, looking like that. I walk in my very first meeting. I remember walking in. Loser. Yep. Scumbag. Yep. I know that dude from school. And I'm not like you. And let me tell you why I'm not like you. Because I'm a smooth drunk. I'm a Cary Grant drunk. That's what I am. I start drinking, and the first place it hits me is right here on the cheeks. Right on the top. And they start getting numb and tingly right here. And I just start smiling. I have a couple more drinks, I start smiling even bigger. A couple more drinks, all of a sudden I want to wrestle you. A couple more drinks, I decide I want to take a walk. It's night. So I head down the street, and I see a light on. So I go up and knock on the door. Hey, saw the light on. Who are you? What are you doing in there? That's me. I'm a visiting drunk guy, is what I am. Like, I'm the kind of drunk that shows up in your picnic, man. You know what I mean? Like, do you know that, dude? It's like, what's up? Right? I can't tell you the amount of times I've been arrested when I wasn't involved. Do you know what I mean? I actually had a cop tell me what, because I just happened to be walking by and decided they needed my assistance in there, you know? I had a cop look at me one time, and he goes, how are you involved in this? I go, I was just walking by. And he goes, you're the only one going to jail. So anyway. So
So that's what's going on. And I'll tell you, do you want to know what I heard in that meeting? You want to know what I heard? I heard pride. Pride. Do you know that Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place besides prison where people try to be the worst? Are you aware of this? Have you ever listened in these meetings? Unbelievable. You get men and women wearing the word homeless like a badge.
I was homeless.
You get men and women wearing the word convict like a badge.
I've been arrested 187 times, dog.
We'll go for 188. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. So damaging. So hurtful. And it doesn't got a damn thing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, I got an argument with this old timer one time. And he said to me, he starts talking about how AA is failing now. And all this crap. And I looked at him and said, you know what, buddy, man? You failed us. Don't you tell me that we failed us. You failed us. Because you sat here in these meetings and you let this shit go down and you didn't stand up for what you believed in. Don't tell me that we have failed. About what goes on in these meetings. You go to some of these meetings, you know, you can go to any of these discussion meetings and you make the topic resentment, every hand in the room goes up. Everybody's got something to say about resentment. You make it anger. You make it fear. Everybody's got something to say. Have you ever been to an AA meeting at Christmas time? It seriously sounds like we all just stepped out of Dickens' Christmas Carol, the way we talk about our families in here. You go to that same meeting and you say, what was it like to read your fourth step to another person? You see how many hands go up. You go in that same meeting and say, what was the hardest amends you ever had to make? You see how many hands go up. You go in that same meeting and say, what does your 11th step look like? What do you do to be of service? How do you help? And see how many hands go up. And then you tell me that our program's failing. Anyway, that pride stuff kills us. And I'll tell you, most of the guys talk about that stuff. The guys that talk about that stuff, they do it because they can't talk about recovery. So they can talk about that. But you know what? We can walk into any bar and hear that crap. It's got nothing to do with recovery. Not a damn thing to do with our program. But I'll tell you, for the guys that have been arrested that many times, and I'm one of you, we need you in here. But not why you think we need you. We need you so when the next person comes walking through our door and says, I've been arrested 187 times, you walk up and you say, me too. That's where my alcoholism took me. And you share your story. You know who else we need in here? We need the person that hasn't been arrested one time. Not one arrest. So when that person comes walking through our door and says, but I've never been arrested, you walk up and say, neither have I. And you tell your story. One's useful to God and our fellows. One is useful to nothing but our pride. Nothing but our pride. And I'll tell you, there's a couple of terrible trends in AA going on right now. And one of them is this cookie-cutter sobriety shit. That they think everyone needs to have this experience, and you will be sober. Let me tell you something. If there was only one experience, there would only be one story in the back of the big book. But it's not. There's all sorts of stories in there because we have all sorts of experiences. It's not one tool. Not one tool for everyone in here. It's 2 million tools. 2 million tools. Anyway, sorry about all that. All right, so I listen to that crap in the meeting. I judge myself non-alcoholic and I take a walk. And I decide I'm out of here because I'm not like you. But I will quit drinking. And I did quit. I quit a whole bunch of times. I was always quitting. Quitting and starting, quitting and starting. One of these times I quit, I got 30 days. 30 solid days. No meetings, no God, no nothing. 30 solid days. And on my 30th day, I got a job as a bartender. Because I thought that'd be a good job. And you know what? It is a good job. If you have properly worked the first step, being a bartender is an excellent job. Make very good money being a bartender. If you have not properly worked the first step, getting a job at the library is a bad idea for you. Going to the market to get milk is probably not a good idea if you have not properly worked the first step. Anyway, I had not properly worked the first check. Got a job as a bartender. On my way to work, I stopped by a friend's house to pick up some mushrooms for another friend. I was dean of service at the time. My buddy asked me, he goes, Jack, how's it going? I go, Lester, it's going real good, man. I go, it's going real good. I got 30 days. I'm solid. Mom's good. Andre's girl's good. She's gone. Baby's gone. They moved out. Everything's looking good. I got 30 days. I'm solid. Is that your bong? Bam! Alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful, disguised itself as a skunk bud and hid in this dude's bong. Anyway, I love that, because the old guy goes, is he talking about drugs? No, sir, I am not. Anyway, so I reach out and I take a bong hit, and I come to with the bong in my mouth. And I think, oh my God, I just took a bong hit. Here I am, I'm sober. I'm stoned. Bam, that's that. Do you know that the big book talks about that? It doesn't say the word bong. You will not find the word bong in the big book. But what it does say that's even more frightening is strange mental blank spots while sober. Not drunken blackouts, sober blackouts. Way more frightening. Every once in a while I'll get new guys and they act like they're trying to pass a test to get in here. They want to tell you how crazy they were. You know what I mean? I was so crazy. I was so insane. I was sneaking and creeping and going down alleys with my pants down. I hadn't slept in 7 months. I was insane. No, you're not insane. You're on drugs. God rest, give Mother Teresa speed for 2 weeks, she'd start building bikes. It's got nothing to do with it at all. And as a matter of fact, they can't even find out you're insane until you're sober. That's when they find out you're insane. If you ever get a chance to go a real 12-step call and not just take a guy and dump him a detox, but if you have a guy at your house with you and you got to give him some booze and wean him off and take him through the night, sometimes you got to take those guys to the hospital like the big book talked about. And when they're drunk and they're messed up and they're out of their mind and you roll over to the hospital, the doctor doesn't come out and go, oh, looks like he's mildly histrionic, maybe a little manic or bipolar. No! He says, strap that drunk's ass to a gurney, and when he sobers up, we'll diagnose. When he sobers up, you can't find out you're insane until you're sober. And if you're struggling with the word insanity, switch it with delusional. It's a little easier to swallow. I'm not fat. These pants are tight. Delusional. That's delusional. I'm not an alcoholic. Those cops are pricks. Delusional. An inability to see the truth when it's laid right in front of you. Delusional. Same thing as insanity. Same deal. Anyway, I take that bong hit. I come to you with a bong in my mouth. I think, what am I going to do now? I overreacted on all that sober thing. I got 30 days. Anybody that can get 30 days definitely does not have a problem. And I'm getting a little dry from the weed. I need a little drinky poo to wash this down. Well, now I'm drinking and smoking weed. So these mushrooms are not going to get delivered. Anyway, I go to work and I was fired. I was fired half an hour on my first day on the job. And I'm downtown and I'm staggering around. I'm out of my mind. I'm 5 grams into a very bad evening by that time. And one of you guys sees me and picks me up. He says, Jack, do you need some help? I'm like, yeah, man. Can you take me to my mom's house? I'm losing it. And the guy goes, yeah. He drives me home, and when he drops me off, he says, we'll talk tomorrow. Tomorrow, 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 tomorrow. I'm like, all right, I get it, bro. We'll talk tomorrow. Now, I know what we'll talk tomorrow means. We'll talk tomorrow is code word for lecture. That's what it means. It means you're too hammered to yell at right now. I'll come back and yell at you in the morning. I mean, even the big book says we're not supposed to work with wet drunks unless the family needs help. Let them go. Let the wet ones go. Do you know why? Because they don't understand what you're talking about. Have you ever seen two wet drunks trying to help each other? You know what I mean? They got a whole different language, man. The one guy, look, well, I got to see me kicking down that 7 miles to you, man. The other guy looks at him and goes, none of the others have been wise and chicken. What? And they'll go on like that for an hour. And you're going to walk into the middle of that and say, I'd like to talk to you about a God solution of Alcoholics Anonymous. Really? Really? They just look at you and go, blah, 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 blah. They don't understand. So the next day, me and this guy are talking on the phone. And we're talking nice. And he's not saying nothing about me being hammered. And he's seen me coming in and out of these meetings. And he's not bringing it up. So I bring it up. I go, oh, man. I got hammered last night, huh? He goes, yep. I go, hey. Woo. I go, last night, huh, bro? He goes, yep. What I was waiting for is, Jack, you're a loser. Jack, you're a scumbag. Jack, you're an animal. Jack, you're trash. I've heard it my whole life. Loser, scumbag, animal, trash. I'm waiting to hear it from this guy. Because he's a we don't drink, and we definitely don't do any mushrooms up in here either, AA guy. Who has seen me coming in, out, coming late, getting a date, leaving early, in and out. Seen me disrespecting his steps, disrespecting his traditions. I'm waiting to get yelled at, and it ain't coming. I go, dude, I blew 30 days. I got drunk, man. He goes, Jack, I know. He goes, you know what? You're probably an alcoholic. And if you're an alcoholic, you can't stop drinking. And if you do stop, you can't stay stopped for any length of time. That was the first time in my life I ever heard that. I wish he was still here. He was a wonderful guy. But 2 weeks later, he relapsed, went out, and died that night in the car. And man's name was Don Langston. When I turned 15, I laid my chip at his grave, looked at the headstone, never realized it before, but he was only 21 years old when he died. I got sober on January 8th of 1989. It's a Sunday. No big deal. One more try. And I did this stuff that you guys had me do. I showed up, and I did a little fourth step, and I did this stuff, blah, 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 blah. But you know what? Every time I sat in that meeting and said I was an alcoholic, a little voice inside my head said, no, you're not. No, you're not. Not really. Not really. Every time. Like I was lying to be an alcoholic. For a year and a half, I did 12-step work, stuck a hand out, all that crap. But it wasn't until I was a year and a half that I really worked the first step. I was sitting in a meeting, and all of a sudden I realized that I was going to drink again. And you couldn't help me. Not a hero sponsor, not 90 and 90, not memorizing every line in that book, not doing any of this crap, because I knew there was going to be a day where I'm going to walk in a meeting and say, I don't belong here, I'm not with you, I'm going to leave, and I'll just stop drinking by myself. Because I've done it over and over again, and I saw myself as I really was. What hit me at that moment was utter hopelessness. Like the book talks about, that first step where I realized I was done for and there was no hope. What hit me right after that was you guys were staying sober and you guys were doing it. And if I did what you did, I also could stay sober. You know, you'll hear a lot of people talk about the word powerlessness. They'll go, I'm powerless. I'm powerless over alcohol. I'm powerless over my shirt. I'm powerless over this stuff. Do you know how many times the word powerless appears in the 164? One time. One time. And it's past tense. And it's plural. We admitted we were powerless. No longer. Do you know when it says power returns in the big book? Right before step 3. Right when we sit in here and look around and see others staying sober, and when we say, I can do this too. I can do this too. The book says, as we felt new power rush in. Before we've even done a third step. The meeting's about power. About power. The program's about power. Power. Anyway, I'll shut up with this. one more thing about the little voice, and I'll end with this. I've got a lot of great messages around here from people that have died. And just because, like, you'll hear people say in here, they'll say, stick with the winners, stick with the winners. Just because they get loaded, it doesn't make them losers. There's good messages around here. We're sitting here because Ebby brought a message to Bill. Ebby couldn't stay sober till the end of his life, but he carried a message to Bill. And the message I got of the 11th step came from a man who's now dead. He relapsed and he died. He's not with us anymore. But he mentioned something to me, and he said that we start to get in touch with the voice inside. The voice inside, by the longer we get sober. And he says there's a little voice in a musical term, and it's called the sotto voce. And it means the little voice underneath. And he really got me thinking about that, and I was thinking about it, and especially driving up here with my wife, because the little voice underneath is not always the first voice I hear. It's like an orchestra. I'm going down the street, and all of a sudden somebody cuts off in front or cuts me off, and the first thing that goes are the kettle drums. Kill him, kill him, kill him. They start pounding, right? And then the next thing that comes in is the horns. Get in front and cut him off. Get in front and cut him off. And then the strings come in. Get in front and slow down. Get in front and slow down. And then all after I go through the whole orchestra, all of a sudden, underneath, a sotto voce, the little voice comes in and says, let him go. Let him go. It's okay. You got nowhere to be, man. You're sober. You're in no hurry. You're with a beautiful woman that you love. And you got a great life. And I just want to say thank you for having me on the show.